of David, right? He's taken over the throne. And David has passed away. And when I say unfinished business, there were some things that David had done. He had made, for example, you remember the agreement or the promise he'd made to Shemaiah? That he could live, you know, David would not punish him or kill him for the things that he had done during the rebellions. And, but now that David's gone, Solomon, sort of takes care of getting everything, anyone who could possibly be against him or anyone who was not promoting peace and with Solomon, Solomon kind of dealt with. And so Solomon begins making treaties with other countries. He does that from this point forward several different times, several different nations, but he does it already with Egypt. And how did he make that treaty? How did they seal that agreement? Pretty common. Yeah, it's pretty common thing. He married one of their daughters. But Solomon, you think about his character and who he is right now. It's pretty interesting when Solomon goes and what's his action that causes God to want to bless Solomon? What is it that Solomon went and did? And as a result, God says, what would you ask for? He went and sacrificed, didn't he? And he offered 1,000 sacrifices to God. And after that, God asked him, what is it that you would request? Now, Solomon, new king, there's a lot of things that he could ask for. But we see a good bit of his character of who he is in his response of what he asked for. He wanted to be able to judge righteously. He wanted wisdom. He wanted to be able to lead the people in the best way that they needed to be led, that he could do. And so he asked God for wisdom, to be able to discern, for judgment. And God was very pleased with that. He did not request anything selfishly for himself, but for the benefit of the people, of God's people. So Solomon, God grants him that, gives him wisdom, and he demonstrates that, and the land is at peace, very prosperous, at peace, and he organizes the kingdom, sets up the high priest, Azariah, and Benaiah is his captain now. We're going to meet Adoniram. I put secretary of labor just because that's kind of his job. He was kind of over the labor force. We'll see here in a little bit. But he sets everything up as we go through the lesson. And just remember, you know, we kind of did this before, and I'm not going to take the whole time this time, but in the first 11 chapters is kind of the life of Solomon, right? In 2 Chronicles 1 through 9, the other narrative, the same thing. So it's not a whole lot of material on the chronology and what happens, you know, through his life. Not a lot of detail. But as we see, chapters 5 through 7 and 2 through 7 are devoted to the temple. We're going to cover that tonight, partially, and at least the construction of it and setting it up and some of the preparations and everything that Solomon does for it and the actual building. And then Sunday we'll go over the dedication and the celebration that goes on with that. So, in 1 Kings chapter 5, Solomon, you know, is in a way solidifying the relationships with the surrounding nations. You know, with the, David had those relations with nations. Solomon now as king, is doing the same thing. He sends, or actually King Hiram sends word to Solomon upon when he's appointed the king on congratulations, you know, and well wishing, to him on his appointment. And Solomon responds back to him. And this is what he says. Look in chapter 5, 1 Kings chapter 5, starting in verse 3. So this is what he says. You know that David, my father, was unable to build a house for the name of the Lord, his God, because of the wars which surrounded him until the Lord put them under the soles of his feet. But now the Lord, my God, has given me rest on every side. There is neither adversary nor misfortune. Behold, I intend to build a house for the name of the Lord my God, as the Lord spoke to David my father, saying that your son, whom I will set on your throne in your place, he will build a house for my name. Now, therefore, command that they cut for me cedars from Lebanon, and my servants will be with your servants, and I will give you wages for your servants according to all that you say. For you know that there is no one among us who knows how to cut timber like the Sidonians. And so Hiram hears of this, and he's very pleased with Solomon's and praises him for his attitude, for the message. And he agrees that he'll participate in this and help out Solomon in building. So what they do is, they letters back and forth, the negotiation, Solomon agrees to, give Hiram food abundantly, we'll see here in a minute, and in return, King Hiram of Tyre is going to provide him with all the lumber that he needs. And what they're going to do is, you see on the map, King Hiram is up there at Tyre, and that's where Lebanon is, and very well known for their trees, their cedars. They get cypress, trees, it says. So he's going to fell these trees, and it's up at a kind of an elevation. They're going to throw them down the mountain into the sea. They're going to build rafts out of them, and they're going to float them down, the Mediterranean down to Joppa. Joppa, they're going to bust open the rafts, tear them apart, and that's where the work begins. They're going to tote the lumber, the trees, over toward Jerusalem, you know, for use in building the temple. And there's a lot of it. And he agrees, to do this and, see if I can find it real quick. In return, Solomon's going to provide King Hiram the pay for this, essentially, the negotiation. Every year would give him, and this is kind of converted to what it might be, 125,000 bushels of wheat, 115,000 gallons of olive oil. So he's going to be providing that in return and for food. And the other thing is he's going to send up, servants, men. Solomon's going to conscript or draft, a bunch of the men from Israel here to go up. And he's going to put them on a rotation. Well, they'll go up for a month up to Joppa. I'm sorry, up to, Tyre and work with the Sidonians. And he's going to send, how many was it? 10,000 at a time. He's going to send 10,000 up there at a time, and they're going to work for a month. Then they'll rotate and, 10,000 more will take their place. And those would get to rest for a couple of months. So they were just going to have this continual rotation, 3 month rotation, of going up and helping the Sidonians cut this timber and get it and float it down and, for it. So it's really interesting, I thought, you know, to that part to see how they go about it and some of the details there. 30,000. So they'd rotate 10, you know, each month and be off 2 months, right? All right. So that's kind of the arrangement that they manned. And additionally, Solomon requests craftsmen and need a skilled craftsman who can work gold, silver, metal, even linen. He needs a real good craftsman, and King Hiram sends him, presumably one of his best craftsmen, and his name is Hiram. All right, so you can remember that pretty easy. Hiram and Hiram in this story. Just don't get them mixed up. And one weird fun fact, I guess, or fact. This Hiram, who, and sometimes it's called Hiram Abi. This craftsman is actually who the Masonic Lodge based their whole foundation system on. Was on him. It's completely, there's not very much information here in the Bible, so there's not much secular apparently either, so a lot of it just seems quite fabricated, but, this is him, the foundation they based that on. Anyway, so you've got the two Hirams. King Hiram sends his best craftsman, Hiram down to Solomon, and they use him. He's the one who's responsible for the design, not the design, but the execution of the ornate details that go into the temple here that Solomon's building. And this whole labor force, this 30,000 that we're talking about, are all under Adoniram. And he's over them. All right, so we get into chapter 6 and the construction of the temple. So the preparations are complete. They've got the materials, everything's together. One of the other things they're going to do is they're going to use clay from the Jordan Valley, and the clay is going to be used to make molds. The clay would be built into forms. They're going to pour hot metal. Bronze is what they formed a lot of, made it out of, at least the exterior things that they put out outside the temple in the courtyard. So they'll make the molds out of clay and form them and bring them up into Jerusalem. They're going to be cutting a lot of stones out of a quarry there. And one of the things I read was that there was not even a, I don't remember where it was now, but there was never the sound of chisels. Sorry? Verse 7? Okay, perfect. Yeah, verse 7. It's pretty neat. While it's being built, this stone was built of stone prepared at the quarry, and there was neither hammer nor axe nor any iron tool heard in the house while it was being built. So they cut these stones in place at the quarry and had them exactly to specification, and you know, brought them over to the temple where they're constructing it. They never had to make any modifications. They never had to chisel. They never had to refit or anything. Or maybe if they did, they did it again out there and brought it back. I don't know. But quite an undertaking. There was a lot of so the temple, the structure itself is going to be built out of these stones. But you wouldn't be able to see any of these stones because it's going to be covered over with material. So we'll get to that here in a second. So by the time they actually start constructing this, the temple, it's the fourth year of Solomon's reign. So it's 4 years in, of seemingly preparations have been going on, and getting things ready. And Solomon chooses the site to build the temple. And there's no one, there's some assumptions, there's some guesses of where this temple, Solomon's temple was, but there's nothing concrete about where it's located even today. Nebuchadnezzar comes through and he ransacks through Jerusalem, destroys everything, and you know, time and again, as things happen, no one knows where that is. Some think it's where under the temple that's there today. Or the, whatever it is. Rock of the Dome, something. I don't know. Some of y'all might know more about that. What's there today. But anyway, Solomon chooses the site, and it's where there was a significant event. Remember when David, had taken the census, and we studied that in here. He had taken that census, and we talked about, you know, that he did wrong in that. And as a result, 70,000 men or Israelites were killed, God punished them, because David would have, God gave him the choice, would you rather do this, this, or this? And he chose to be in the hands of God. And so this was the punishment. And David, when that was going on, David went to the threshing floor after that. He went to the threshing floor. Gad, the prophet, tells him to go there. And he goes to Mount Moriah, the floor of Arona, and he offers sacrifices there. Remember how he had offered to give him the what he needed for the sacrifice, and David would not sacrifice anything that didn't cost him something. So he buys the threshing floor, but this is exactly where Solomon decides to build this temple. And in all, it takes 7 years to build it and to go through this and complete it. So we're going to look at a little bit for the rest of the time. And there's not a whole lot. When we remember thinking about the tabernacle, which, you know, was the temporary place for God's presence. Well, this is going to be the permanent structure. Remember thinking about when we studied that, remember all the details about the tabernacle down to what the priest's robes look like and the very details about everything on that and in the temple and the tabernacle as well. We've got a lot of information about that. Here, we don't have that kind of detail at all. It's pretty vague as we look through here. It's pretty vague. We get a kind of an idea of what it looked like, some dimensions, and a few details, but we don't get near the same thing, as God's giving the instructions to Solomon or how that worked, how he received those or how those were given to the craftsman Hiram, to actually build and oversee that work. But what we have, we'll go over and kind of get an idea. So the building itself, the temple, the entire structure was going to be, and these are kind of converted into feet. So the cubits are given for us. So it's something like this. So, about 30 feet wide, 90 feet long, and 45 feet high. So if you can think about that, get that kind of in your mind. There's also a porch on it. The porch was the same width of the building, and it was 15 feet. So it came out 15 more feet for the porch. There's going to be two large pillars, bronze pillars, at the front, of the temple, near the door, and on the porch. And those two bronze pillars at the entrance, they're named. They're named Jachin and Boaz. Jachin, he shall establish. Boaz, it is his, in it is strength. Also, in addition to, what we commonly think of as the holy place and the most holy place, it's not actually referred to that way, I don't think. But that's what's obviously what's in the temple. In addition to that, the exterior sides of this building, still part of the dimensions there, there's going to be, actually, in addition to, there's storerooms that are built, okay, along the sides. I've got a, yeah. So, all right. So this is a side view. And again, we don't have a whole lot of details. So, you know, we only know what's written in the scriptures. But out here is the porch, and it's 15 feet, give or take, inside. This dimension is 30 by 90, 45 feet high. There's storerooms in the bird's eye view here. You can see, here the porch, and the interior, and around the outside are these storerooms, right? It's unclear if they go all the way around or if they're on the sides exactly, but, at least I don't remember it saying that. Let's see. Well, let's go on to the next slide. So the two inner rooms that we have, the holy place, remember where the incense is offered? It's offered, brought in two times a day, and offered, but it measures, 30 by 60 by 45. All right. So the width 30 and then, the length, 60 and still the entire 45 feet high. The most holy place though is an exact cube, 30 by 30 by 30. So it's not as high as the inner room in the Holy of Holies room where the ark and the cherubim sit. And talking about the cherubim that are in, that's in that most inner room, this is not the cherubim that we remember, you know, from the tabernacle. This thing is huge. I think I've got it. I don't remember if I put it on there. I don't think I did. See if I remember. I think it was. So when you walk, if you were to walk in, if you imagine walking into that inner, the holy, most holy place, then the Ark of the Covenant would be there. And it's the same Ark. It's the same one. How long has that thing been around? We're talking 400 plus years. 400. Plus 480. Yeah. All right. So this is a long, long time. So when you walk in there, you'll see that. But to each side of it, facing you, if I remember reading right, facing you, you'll see two cherubim with their wings pointed out, one side touching the ark, the other side touching the wall. So you got these, and these things are huge. They're like 15 feet span or something, you know, really large, stretching pretty much. If two of them are 15, then they're covering wall to wall, exterior wall to wall with the ark, which remember the ark, how big is the ark? It wasn't a big thing, was it? So it's sitting, you know, beneath, you know, seems like beneath the wings between them. So anyway, we have a kind of a somewhat of a mental picture of that. So we talked about the stones being the main substrate or structure here, but they used wood paneling, cedar wood paneling, I think it was, to cover all of the rocks, all right, on the inside, and they also used that same paneling on the ceiling, and they also had wood floors, all right, but you didn't see any wood when you walked in either, because everything was overlaid with gold. I mean, all of this, so floor, walls, ceiling, everything. And so when you walked in, even it was talking about the doors, the casings of the doors, you know, and the everything around was made out of, it was overlaid with this gold. And that part I can't really imagine. The most gold I've seen is really tiny. Anyway. But anyway, so it's everywhere. And it's hard for me. I can't really get a mental picture of what that would look like. If it would be just shiny, or, you know, I don't know. But anyway, so that's what we've got. We've got the two rooms, and between the two, remember, there's a wall between them. There's a door, an entrance, and over that door there is a veil with gold chains, it said, and linen. Not specific at all about what that looked like or anything. But going to the exterior, going to the outside in the courtyard, then was you remember the altar of burnt offerings? And that thing was, honestly, I remember teaching, I said, this thing was really big. You know, it was going to be about 7-ish feet, 8 feet, you know, big square, big thing. They actually built ledges up on it for them to work up on, and, you know, with meat hooks and things to put the sacrifices on and so forth. Well, then we get this altar here. It's 30 feet by 30 feet by 15 feet high. This thing's massive. And I don't know, it doesn't say anything about a ledger board for them to get up on, but something, you know, I had to give for them to get up there and work on it and to do the sacrifices and so forth. So this thing was awfully, awfully large. It was bronze, cast in bronze. Go ahead and talk about the wall. The courtyard was surrounded by a wall. They made it, it just says that it was 3 rows deep. So it was a thicker wall, you know, as it went down. Not just a skinny wall. But we've got that around the courtyard. And then this other, the Sea of Bronze and the bronze basins, seems to take the place of the laver, you know, where they would, you know, wash and do that ceremonial cleanness when they needed to enter the priest went in to do their work. Well, this thing, it's referred to as a sea, and this thing is massive. It's round, 45 feet in diameter. So, and then it's about 7.5 feet deep. So, if you do the calculations, this thing's got a lot of water in it, to the tune of 17,000 plus gallons of water in this thing. And so these basins were also around, and these bronze basins were put on carts or some way to move them around. And they used those to clean the utensils that they were using, you know, with dealing with the burnt offerings and things. So all of that's in the courtyard. And just as a matter of just a little bit more information, the storerooms that were around that along the exterior, they they made them so that, you know, you have the exterior wall of the temple itself. The first storeroom was only about, I don't remember what it was, like 7.5 feet or something. I forget the cubics, but it was actually thinner or smaller, in width than the one on top. I don't know if I mentioned that. There was actually 3 stories of these storerooms. I don't know if I mentioned that. So they're layered. And the bottom storerooms were actually smaller than the one that was on top, was a little bit larger, and the one on top was a little bit larger. So it sort of pyramided up to the actual wall of the interior of the, you know, the temple itself. And it says they had a winding staircase to get from level to level. So, a spiral staircase, of some sort. And it was to store the, you know, there's a lot of, you know, this was the place of worship. Remember sometimes how many thousands and thousands of sacrifices they would do, you know, at times. Solomon had already, you know, we talked about, had done that. So there'd be a whole lot of supplies, a whole lot of offerings that would be brought. And so these rooms were to store everything that they needed to carry on the worship. That gets us through chapter 6 and ready for chapter 7, in our material. Now, with all of that, you're gonna laugh at, I'll laugh at the next slide, because these are the thoughts I had. I couldn't think of any application, you know. It's not even, you know, but with the tabernacle, God was very specific. They had to follow specifically, you know, what God had ordered. Well, we don't really have that here. We don't have God specifically laying out this one. We don't have it recorded for us anyway. So it's up to y'all to have some thoughts. but anyway, that's the material, and I don't have anything else. I knew this was going to be quick and short, and we were going to have time left over. Does anybody have any thoughts? You know, I think I read, well, I don't know if I can come up with it, but it wasn't the same lampstands as we were accustomed to in the tabernacle either. So I think there was more, and they were on both, it was like they were on both sides of the room as well. 5 on each side. Okay, thank you. So it was different than the tabernacle. It may be very bright in there. You know, it may have been much more substantial. Then there was windows cut into this one, by the way. You know, the storerooms did not go all the way up the 45 feet. According to the cubits and the dimensions they gave, the storerooms, the 3 levels, didn't go all the way up. The inner went up a little bit higher. And they cut out, I don't remember, was it 2 windows? And they were just open, but they made it so that it was narrow on the outside and wider, you know, when it cut through the stone. It was kind of in that shape. But it would let light in, but still nobody could really see in or out, of the rooms. All right. Well, I'm going to let you, go, and you can muse yourselves for the next few minutes. We'll start up with, chapter 7, Sunday. And this is when the dedication will occur, and the celebration, and the feast that, and the Solomon's prayer, and, you know, God coming in and filling the temple. We'll cover all that Sunday. All right. Thanks for your attention.